Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Either Meryl Streep or Raven Simone. Possibly Bruce Willis.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This episode brings the return of one of my favorite guests, the Dean of Obscene Fake Children's Literature, Adam Mansbach. As every parent knows, Adam is the author of the parody children's book, Go the Fuck to Sleep, and its brand new sequel just out, You Have to Fucking Eat. In addition to writing short books with lots of curses, Adam is also the author of a bunch of amazing novels, like The End of the Jews, Angry Black White Boy, and Rage is Back. He also recently wrote a supernatural thriller called The Dead Run that we talk about in this interview. Adam is, as becomes abundantly clear in the course of our talk, a giant hip-hop fan. We talked to Adam at our home, Crosstown Studios in Harlem, while he was in New York doing a press run for You Have to Fucking Eat. For the new book, for You Have to Fucking Eat, which MC influenced your rhymes the most?
For this book or in general?
For this book.
I'm locked into a pattern here. You know, I'm locked into an ABCB type of thing. So I don't know if there's any direct. I mean, most of my favorite MCs are people whose style is all about switching up the flow and doing unexpected things. So I don't know who influenced it the most, but I am, as a form of promotion for this book, doing a song with Jean Grey. It's me, Jean Grey, and my daughter, who goes by the name the Jazz Wolf.
Perfect name. That's
great. She made that up. She's the Jazz Wolf. I don't even know why or how. She's just like, yo, Papa, I'm the Jazz Wolf. I'm like, all right. as soon as Jean like records her shit, we're gonna try to put that out. I'm pretty pleased with it. My daughter kills it.
That's amazing. It's gonna be
she's the baddest 6-year-old MC in the game.
But is she as bad as Jordy, 4-year-old French baby rapper?
Oh, nah. Fuck that. My daughter's badder than any French baby.
You should watch the video sometime if you haven't. It's insane. He's like making out with another baby. It's really disturbing.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah. It's pretty awful.
And exploitive.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
I think radio stations in Europe actually stopped playing him for a while because they were worried that his parents were exploiting him, which I think is pretty obvious.
That seems clear. I mean, it's a fine line between like being inspired by your kid and making your kid like the center of your marketing campaign. And I've very much actually tried to avoid doing that. Like when Go the Fuck to Sleep came out and now again with the new book, it's always, will you do a photo shoot with your daughter? Can we do a segment on our cooking show where you and the Jazz Wolf come in and like cook pancakes together. I'm like, nah, that's not gonna happen, you know? She would probably be cool with it at this point, but it just seems like she's not really able to make that decision yet, and I'd rather err on the side of not having her in the limelight any more than these books already mean that she is.
Right. I was gonna ask about that because you talked about having her in like this reading and she was like, first realized she was famous and like she's old enough to understand that she and her friends are like on the cover of these books and in the illustration. Like, how has that kind of realization been seeping in?
It's interesting because she understands that she's famous, and yet at the same time she doesn't understand really what fame means. It's a completely abstract concept that has no bearing on her life. And also, like, I should say, this is all, you know, my daughter is not like fucking Tom Cruise's kid or something. She's not Blue Ivy. It's not like motherfuckers are trying to like photograph her.
Not that many paparazzi.
The paparazzi around our way is limited at best. But she understands that she's famous, that these books exist in the world, that they're out there, but it doesn't really have any bearing on her life. And I think for a kid, whatever their reality is completely normative, you know? So for my daughter, it's totally normal that practically everybody she knows, the people who come through, the people who stay at our house are writers, are graffiti artists. It's normal for her to like get in the car and, you know, drive for a few minutes and get out and see a wall like with a 20-foot mural of her name on it that her uncle Keo just did, because like that's her man. And she, you know, they kicked it at our house, and Keo's painting a permission wall in Oakland, and he's like calling me up like, yo, is it V-I-V-I-E-N? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, bet. And I'm like, oh shit, here we go. You know, that's just regular shit for her, like, which is great. I'm happy to have her living that kind of life where she's exposed to people who are passionate and doing what they want to do. For me as a kid, like, one of the most important things, like, in my life was simply the knowledge that my father loved his job. You know, he went to work every day excited to put out a newspaper.
You say he was a newspaper guy, right?
Yeah, Boston Globe.
Yeah.
And that he was just, remains to this day, excited to do it. So if nothing else, I like the idea that my daughter's around people who are excited about what they do, happy to be doing what they're doing, feeling like they're making some kind of contribution and are in dialogue in a significant way, you know, with the world.
That's awesome. One thing I was wondering about with this book is, like, last time you talked about, like, vaulting into the mainstream and how it was weird and you didn't expect it and it was viral all of a sudden, and then you were on the Today Show and, like, what's happening? And this time it's more planned. Like, you knew the book was coming out. You had a release date. You know, you'd been on a lot of this stuff before and, you know, knew that they probably would want to have you back. What was it like to kind of, like, know you're going to make this jump for a few weeks or a few months or whatever it is back into, like, you know, mainstream media world?
It was exciting and a little nerve-wracking because obviously the stakes, it's not even that they're higher, it's that they exist at all. You know what I mean? So there was a lot of strategizing. There was a lot of internal discussion. Luckily, my publisher, Akashic Books, is a small sort of locally run business. It's about 6 full-time employees. It's in Gowanus. And those guys are my team, and they're great, and they're my friends. So I was in the same situation in the sense that I hadn't leaped to a corporate publisher. I was working with the same team. We all remembered what happened last time. The publisher, Johnny Temple, is a buddy of mine. Everybody there are people that I consider friends. So that mitigated the stress considerably because we were all on the same page. We were all planning and strategizing together. And yeah, there was a blueprint because the book, the previous book, Go the Fuck to Sleep, had found this audience. So it was about how do we reach back out to them. You know, we'd maintained contact with them over the past 4 years through the Facebook page and through whatever else I'm doing. But it actually felt good to apply a lot of the knowledge. I've always been a pretty hands-on artist. I've always taken as much control over the publicity, the marketing, the advertising copy for my books as I could, because I feel like I know my audience better than they do, and I'm in it for the long haul, whereas the typical publicist working at a big publishing house is there for like 6 to 8 months. And the editor might be there for 6 to 8 months. There's all this turnover. And that's another reason that staying with Akashic was a good look. I know that as long as that company exists, Johnny Temple will be running it, not somebody new. So, you know, it was anxiety making, but also fun. I mean, it's great to put out a product that you're pretty sure is going to do something. Putting out a literary novel is like just, you know, throwing shit into the void and hoping for the best.
Right. There was something you mentioned in the last interview, actually, that got me thinking, was like, you said you thought you saw like the children's books, fake children's books, whatever, is like basically a mashup, right, of like your internal monologue and, you know, a standard children's book with the 14 verses or whatever it is.
Right.
And I was like, do you think that it's like, because you grew up in hip hop, because you got the idea of like, oh, I can take, you know, drums from the Monkees and, you know, the horns from somewhere else and like, and it's a new thing. Do you think that kind of like seeped in, and that's why the idea of like a collage was so natural?
Yeah, I think that being steeped in that culture of collage and of mashup and of juxtaposition certainly informs my thinking. I think it informs my thinking as a writer. It informs my ideas about comedy and what's funny. It's hard to say because in the absence of those influences, I have no idea who I'd be. I'd literally be a completely different person. But yes, I mean, I'm a hip-hop aesthetic dude. Like, it informs everything I do, among other influences. It's not absent in anything. And I think even beyond the mashup idea or the juxtaposition, I think even on a deeper level than that, Go the Fuck to Sleep and You Have to Fucking Eat fit in with my body of work, in the sense that what I want to do as a writer is sort of tell uncomfortable truths and grapple with paradox and complexity. That might take a much different form in, you know, Rage Is Back or The End of the Jews or one of my novels. It fucking better, because those books take years to write. But I think that same idea animates Go the Fuck to Sleep, animates You Have to Fucking Eat. It's the paradox of loving your kid to death, but also being incredibly frustrated at what they're doing and needing to vent about it. And that's a truth that wasn't necessarily a palatable one when that first book came out. I mean, the climate into which that book dropped didn't have room for that, and that book essentially made room for that. And that's also a hip-hop thing, is sort of like creating your own space, forcing your way into the conversation, plugging into a light post, throwing a party in, you know, an asphalt schoolyard. Like, you make the spaces that you need, and you make the art that you need, or the art that you hope other people need.
Yeah. Another thing that book did that didn't exist when the climate came out was, I didn't even realize this till the Time story came out, but there was like other fake children obscene books. There was like a whole bunch of them, which was...
Yeah, there was a spate of sort of...
Yeah.
Imitations, I would say.
Yeah. So do you ever, were you ever tempted to run up on them like Onyx bitch-ass bootlegger style?
Onyx tip, 399, my friend. Come by for me. No, no.
The bitch-ass bootlegger motherfucker selling my tape. They get shot.
It was, yeah, it's always tempting, but I mean, I think the better move was to basically ignore them. A lot of them approached me to give them blurbs or to like shout them out or endorse them in some way, or to like make an introduction to my publisher. I'm like, y'all must be fucking kidding me. You know, seriously, get the fuck out of here with that bullshit, you know? Not just because it was derivative, but also because when I did bother to look, it didn't have what I considered to be like the crucial sentiment of my book. Not that I would have been happier if it had, but they seemed to be absent the kind of affection that actually underwrites my books and makes them good rather than being offensive. You know, like, these books are actually based in what ought to be clearly like a very engaged and loving form of parenting.
Right. It's not just, kid, I want to knock you the fuck out or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And I would go on radio shows and hosts would be like, hey, I got your sequel here. Because every like morning show host in the country is like the same dude, basically. And I'd like go on these radio tours where you sit in a room and, you know, you do a 10-minute interview. After the next 10-minute interview, you do it for 2-3 hours. And you talk to, like, literally 35 guys named Steve or Rick with a sidekick named, like, Crankshaft or Booger or whatever the fuck. And, like, they'd always end the interview with the same shit. They'd always be like, hey, we got a couple ideas for sequels. And you're like, hit me, Steve. It's going to be amazing. And you're like, hey, how about, like, you ruined my fucking life and I'm going to throw you off a bridge. I'm like, Steve, you're fucked up. You know that? You fucked up in the game, Steve. That's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. And you actually, like, probably need help, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's not the sentiment that I'm going for at all.
Yeah, speaking of interviews like that, doing the same thing over and over, like, so, you know, obviously in advance of, like, the times we'll talk, I'll do a little bit of internet stalking around, you know, press and stuff. And I'll find, like, you know, you'll have a handful of lines that will come up in different interviews or points you want to make. And obviously that's necessary if you're giving the same interview, you know, essentially over and over, answering similar mm-hmm. questions. I guess I'm just wondering what that's like for you, that you go into an interview and someone starts. So what I want to know is, and you can already tell the mm-hmm. next 20 minutes of the conversation, like, where's your head at a moment like that?
It allows me to think about other things while I'm doing the interview. It allows me to, like, recite, like, Criminal Minded in its entirety while doing the interview, which is amusing for me. No, I mean, I think that there's certainly an art. I mean, first of all, like, you owe it to the person interviewing to sound as engaged as you possibly can. It's, you know, a wonderful thing for anybody to be paying attention, giving a fuck, wanting to interview you. And I appreciate that. Like, I never want to be that dude who's, like, bored and jaded and doesn't want to be doing press. Nah, I'm thrilled that I can even make a living doing any of the shit I do. That said, yeah, I do get questions that are the same a lot. And I remember having a discussion about this in, like, 2005, 2006 with Oliver Wang when I was on tour with Bakari Kitwana's Rap Sessions, which was like a movable feast of hip-hop scholars talking at that time about race and hip-hop. And it was me, Oliver, Bakari, Ernie P., Raquel Rivera was like the squad at that time.
So you guys solved race and hip-hop? That's all figured out?
Yeah.
Okay,
great. Then the next year they solved gender and hip-hop.
Okay.
And here we are in a utopian world. But like, I remember Oliver kind of like joking with me and being like, dude, you say the same shit every night. And I'm like, you're fucking right I do, Oliver, because I get asked the same question and I know what my answer is. And I'm not going to change the answer. You ask me the same question, I know what I want to say. And I have my points worked out, and I know what's funny, and I know how to deliver that. I would rather give the same good answer than try to make up a new answer every time, because you're right, I get the same question hundreds of times, and I'm not going to answer it in exactly the same words, but if I try to be original every time in deference to some non-existent audience that's already heard this repeatedly, I'm going to end up being completely incoherent, more so than I already am, you know? So I don't have a problem trotting out the same answer or even making the same joke, because at heart I'm a Borscht Belt comedian, and that's just what it is.
It's true. I think Jean is too, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why we get along.
She had that one line about, like, her one line on the mixtape track about the Catskills, like,
yeah,
seeing the Catskills, like, look at her rap skills, and I was like, okay, well, this is it, obviously.
Yep. Yep, and I yeah, absolutely. I mean, that tradition is alive and well for me. Yeah, like my at this point, like my stage show, such as it is, I'm trying to emulate like late Dean Martin, like when he's almost too drunk to stand up and not actually singing any songs, just like slurring and like making private jokes with like Freddie Prinze Sr., who's like at the bar,
right,
also about to pass out, and Sammy Davis and those guys.
But I have an adorable little wife, old Jeannie. I think she's pretty. She's a dear. And I can't wait till the season opens. But I got enough gas to go to Pittsburgh.
That's kind of like my model. Like, I just want to be talking shit.
Like the pre-song monologue, but just extended.
Yeah, pre-song monologue, no song.
Right.
That's how I'm getting down.
Since obviously you're a rap fan, you write books for kids, or about kids, maybe not for kids. Who is your favorite child rapper?
My favorite child rapper?
Yeah. Say 15 and under.
15 and under?
Yeah.
How old was Shaheem when he came out?
He was that, I think he was.
Actually, no, you know what? No. My answers are going to be Special Ed and Kwame. People don't understand how young those dudes were when they came out.
Oh.
Special Ed and Kwame were like 15, 16 writing those albums, which is incredible. Two of the most underrated dudes out.
Yeah, that first Kwame album is fucking
incredible.
Yeah, it's
and he produced that album. And he was ghost producing for Herbie. You know what I mean?
I didn't know that, yeah.
Kwame is that dude, man. DJ Frayn was at my house in the Bay not too long ago, and we were, I don't know, these things happen. You end up having a 45-minute discussion about Kwame. So we pulled out that album and listened to it front to back.
Yeah.
It's 9 songs on there. 8 of them are bangers. One is a shitty love song.
Right, I remember the ballad.
The others, yeah. But, you know, whatever, it's 89. Everybody had to do, like, some type
of
ballad.
At least there's not a house song.
Right. But, I mean, the rest of that album is impeccable, and his rhymes are ridiculous.
I like the flow. That's what I do with the tempo. The end to the intro. The quan begins so smooth. So push the panic button. Act like a frantic nothing. A nut house. Put and dance. Step together. Move and help skelter. Run and find shelter. I felt a sudden rush when my beat began. And God forbid if I had no pen, because without a pen, I'd be...
Like, in retrospect, Kwame might be a top 10 MC for 1989. We didn't, like, I wouldn't have thought so at the time, because he wouldn't have been in the weight class with guys like Chris and Chuck and Rakim and Kane and G-Rap. But, like, really, pound for pound, he's up there. He was killing it back then.
And he didn't weigh much, pound for pound.
No, he didn't weigh much.
Just chronic kid. What about, you know, I was listening on the way here, I was thinking about this, I was re-listening to Chi Ali, and, like, his first album's pretty creepy. He's talking about, like, he's 14, he's talking about, like, having sex with 17-year-olds, dating 23-year-olds.
I said, how old are you? She said, 17. I said, so what? I could get in between. So she is rap, is an art. Everybody is amazed with Chi Ali. Because I'm 14 and my girl is 23.
Chi Ali was living that life, man.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about Chi Ali is there's the one 12-inch. I want to say it's the, what's it, Let the Horns Blow, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, like, the original and the remix. On the original, he can't really rap at all.
Well, it's me, Chi Ali. Everywhere I go, I get sparked by
But between the time that was recorded and the remix, he learned how to rap. It's one of those songs where it's like, not only is it remixed, but like an incredible amount of growth apparently happened in whatever time span went from the album version to the remix.
Get a taste of the lemon, lima, rhymer, I'm from Mac, a frack, a lack, a ripping tracks like a tractor, rap reactor with more than a bionic man. I'm blowing up as if I was atomic. No gold.
It's striking. Really amazing. Striking.
And I the last time I talked to you was like you and Kevin, I don't know, last year sometime. And it was right around the time of the Dead Run.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this idea of like, you know, you had to write a thriller. Okay, what's a thriller? How does it work? Okay, let's jump in. First of all, looking back on that whole process, like writing it and then dealing with like, oh, there's a whole audience of thrillers, you know, at which we saw at Comic-Con.
Right.
What was that like? And then also like, could you see yourself doing that again for like science fiction or whatever?
Well, I just did a sequel to The Dead Run. I had a 2-book deal. So The Dead Run came out, a year and a half ago maybe.
Yeah.
And the sequel I just turned in, it's called The Devil's Bagman. And it'll come out, I think, early next year. And the question in my mind now is, do I re-up and do a third one? Doing a thriller was fascinating because it was a new set of parameters, and that's always intriguing to me, whether that's a screenplay or an obscene fake children's book or a rap song. It's like these things all have parameters. They all have rules. How do you figure out those rules? How do you innovate, have fun within them? Doing the second one, the learning curve was not as steep because I'd already done it once. I'd already figured out what doing a thriller meant to me. But it was steep in other ways because I had to write a sequel, and I'd never done that before. And The Dead Run kind of is an explosive book where I leave the main character in a very bizarre state. I knew I had to write a sequel, but I also was hedging my bets because at the time I got the deal, it was a 2-book deal. It wasn't specified that I had to do a book and a sequel. It was just specified that I had to do 2 books. So in my mind, I'm thinking, all right, if the first book doesn't sell at all, why do a sequel to it? Why not just move on and do another one-off? So as I finished The Dead Run, I was like, let me leave this in a place where it could be a wrap. It could be an ambiguous, weird ending that is just an ending. Or it could be a kind of Empire Strikes Back ending where, you know, you pick up from there and it's clear you're going to keep going. It turns out that the way that that industry works, that thriller, commercial fiction industry works, is it's all based on series. They're not tripping if the first book doesn't sell. The second book is meant to pick up the first book. The third book picks up the previous two. And by the time you're 6 books into the series, you've picked up 8,000 fans each book, and everybody is raring to go. They'll invest in your career on a longer-term basis than on the literary side for that reason, because there's never any continuity between books on the literary side. But the flip side of that is you have to commit to basically giving them a book a year.
Right.
So it's a tricky bargain, and one that for me to keep is not easy because I have other things to do. You know, if I was just writing a thriller a year, I could do it. But if I also want to do all the other stuff I'm doing, not so much. So I was like, all right, well, maybe I'll do something else. Then they were like, no, you're absolutely doing a sequel. I was like, okay, here we go. So I had to figure out how to like reset the chessboard and pick up all the threads of those characters. And, you know, that book ends with the protagonist.
It's like a god or something, right, at the end of it?
Yeah, he ends up by eating the heart of a virgin, which is imbued with the powers of a 500-year-old Aztec priest who in turn stole those powers from an ancient Aztec god who is imprisoned in a nether realm called the Dominio Gris, the Gray Realm. And in so doing, because he's distantly related to this priest, he ends up essentially, like, sharing his... Like, the dude's spirit is, like, trapped in his body. So the book ends with the protagonist, like, sharing a body with the spirit of this evil, ancient, semi-deity, demigod. That's a hell of a place to pick up.
Right.
And that's a hell of a thing to try to write a second book around.
You're like, okay, go.
Yeah. So that was tricky, in a way that was enjoyable.
Yeah.
And in the second book, I got to really go much deeper into the mythology of the world that I'd created. And that's, for me, the most interesting and fun part. My main realization about thrillers, which may be completely wrong, but it's the one I'm going with, my theory is that people don't read these things for, like, the action. You know, they read them for the mythology, whether that's, you know, Anne Rice or Dan Brown. Like, nobody reads The Da Vinci Code because they're, like, interested in the latest, you know, in the, like, hairpin turns of the plot, or, like, the whatever that motherfucker's name is, you know, whether he, like, jumps on the airplane or whatever. It's actually the times when nothing is going on except church history that's fascinating, you know? I'm a big fan of, like, that world building. So in this one, I took the time to, like, do much more of that. So it's not as action-packed. It's still pretty fucking action-packed, but there's the whole history of this world and these characters, and that was, like, fun for me.
And what's promoting something like that, like, because it's different than the literary audience. It's also different than, like, the Today Show in 43 countries or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not review-based. It's not driven by anything except fans. And that world is all about reaching those fans and making a very direct connection with them, as you saw at Comic-Con when I dragged you to that. And all of a sudden, we're at the Javits Center, and 120,000 motherfuckers dressed like Gandalf and Aquaman are, like, walking around. And I'm, like, on a panel. Yeah, what I found myself doing was a lot of book festivals where I'd be on a panel with, like, five other thriller writers. And it's an interesting world. It's a very male world and a very white world, neither of which are paradigms I'm used to, because the work I tend to do, although I am both white and male, puts me in dialogue with people who tend not to be, and I'm more comfortable with that. So that was a little weird. And there's, like, a testosterone palpable in the work and in the rooms. You know, it's a lot, because these guys have to put out a book a year, there's a lot of, like, nose to the grindstone, like, I write 6,000 words a day, rain or shine, I drink 7 Red Bulls, and I knock it out. And it's like, yeah, homie, but you know what, on the low, your prose is fucking terrible. You know, everybody was cool, but I'd literally find myself on these panels where the topic was, like, vampires or zombies. And I'm like, I don't have it. I can't answer it. I don't care. Like, I mean, I do care, but I'm not used to talking about that shit. I don't know whether to wax philosophical or make a bunch of, like, borscht belt jokes, or possibly both. So it was a lot of those things. It was a lot of paneling, a lot of sort of direct outreach. I don't know if it was successful in any way, but I think that more people read that book than I realized. I think HarperCollins did a fairly good job of, like, getting it started, of jump-starting what they probably hope will be a series, and which I'm undecided about whether
you don't know if you're going to get 25 books deep into.
I don't see getting 25 books deep, and I could see doing one more, maybe. But I'll agree to do it, and then I'll bitch and moan about it and be like, why did I say I would do this? I never should have done this. And I'll, like, think about paying somebody else to do it, and then I'll buckle down and do it, and then we'll be having the same conversation in a year. I'll be like, I don't know if I should do a fourth one, man.
Well, at least you've got your life planned out in that way.
Exactly.
For the next decade. It's going to be great. So you knew a bunch of film stuff. You know, you were talking earlier today and something else about the pushcart wars.
Yeah.
My big question is, who's going to star as the pushcart?
That's an interesting question. I think playing the role of the pushcart will be either Meryl Streep or Raven Simone.
Excellent choice.
Possibly Bruce Willis as the Axel.
How is the casting for that going? Do you know anything about it? Are you sort of in the loop on that?
I know a little bit about it, but I'm not sure that I should, like, say much about it.
Yeah.
I'm also doing another film project right now that I'm really excited about, and also can't say that much about, but Vikram Gandhi hired me to write his first feature. He did a great documentary called Kumare, which is basically... Vikram is an Indian dude from New Jersey. He and I went to college together. And Kumare is premised on him being like, I'm kind of sick of people fetishizing India and yoga and gurus. So he grows his hair and his beard out really long, moves to Arizona, and starts a cult around himself as the Indian guru Kumare. And it's a really well-done movie because it begins as a prank. It begins as a Sacha Baron Cohen movie, but it grows a heart as it goes because Vikram realizes that people are actually getting a lot from Kumare, even if Kumare is a construction, and also that somehow he feels more honest within the deception of being Kumare than he does as Vikram. So it's a really well-done thing. He's also a host on Vice TV right now, and he and I are working on a feature set in New York in 1981 that's going to be super fresh, and that I think is going to come together very quickly. So I'm really psyched about that.
That's awesome. That's a time period that's been kind of like a accidental theme of this show.
Oh, really?
I feel like probably about half our shows mentioned Debbie Mazur somehow.
And why shouldn't they, really?
No, really, yeah. You know. But yeah, it's a fascinating period. And so I'm glad like a movie is, you know.
It is a fascinating time. Yeah.
Coming out about that. You had some kind of film thing with Jim Jarmusch. He was involved somehow.
Jarmusch was executive producing a movie that I wrote that never came together. It was a script I wrote for Adam Bala Lowe, who did the Lil Wayne documentary, did a movie called Bomb the System, graffiti movie, and some other things. I met Jim through Adam. I believe Adam did a documentary on the set of Coffee and Broken Flowers, maybe. Anyway, they know each other. So Jarmusch sort of put his weight behind this thing. But, you know, it was a great project, great people involved, but it never came together in terms of getting the money, which is all too often the story with indie films. I've been through it a few times. And at this point, you know, the projects I'm drawn to are the projects that I feel like, okay, aside from like being fresh, like what are the chances we actually get this made? Like I'm sort of, you know, I think I'm at a point where like I can get hired, I can get paid to write scripts, which is cool, but I don't want to write scripts anymore that don't get made. I'd much rather not get paid to write a script that does get made. You know what I mean?
That's a whole different game than writing a book. Presumably, like once you sign a contract for a book, you know, barring major disaster, it's going to be out on shelves, whether mm-hmm. it's the promotional push you want or whatever, like it'll be out there, which isn't the case with movies. You can like work really fucking hard on something and think it's great.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of sits around.
Absolutely. I mean, I know guys in Hollywood who have carved out 20, 30 year careers, lucrative careers, are very comfortable and have never gotten a movie made. They get paid to write and, you know, they're in the Writers Guild and it's all good, but no screen credit.
Oh. One of the things you're doing, I saw, was like a book series with Alan Zweibel, right?
Yeah, Alan and I, yes.
How the fuck do you ever get anything done and not just be like, tell me about It's Gary Shandling Show?
This is the theme to Gary Show. The theme to Gary Show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme?
Because that's what I would do if I were in
Alan,
the same room.
Alan's got amazing stories. I mean, Alan, for those who are not familiar with him, Alan Zweibel is a comedy veteran legend. He was one of the original writers on Saturday Night Live, discovered by Lorne Michaels doing stand-up, like in the Catskills, I think. Billy Crystal would pick him up at his house in Long Island. They'd drive up together. That story Alan told me was that Lorne approached him and was like, that was the worst set I've ever seen, but you're a good writer. Would you like to work for me? Yeah, he's on the Gary Shandling Show. He's been involved with all kinds of projects. I mean, like, we finished the first draft of our book and we agreed that it was time to get a few eyes on it, you know, send it to some friends for read. So I was like, all right, cool. I'll send this to my boy Daniel Alarcon. You know, he's a novelist. I'll send it to my boy Vinny. He's also a novelist. See what they say. They're good readers. And Alan was like, cool. I'll send it to Marty Short and Larry David. I was like, all right, cool. That's what's up. Alan and I met at a book festival in Arizona, I guess 3 years ago now, maybe two years ago now, and just kind of hit it off. Again, it's that like Catskills, Borscht Belt shit. He was a fan of Go the Fuck to Sleep. I knew who he was. We had dinner with some other people. And by the end of dinner, we're like, man, let's do a book together. You know, fuck it. So we came up with an idea, and it's an epistolary novel, it's a series. It's a middle grade series. The title is Benjamin Franklin, Huge Pain in My Ass. And it's about a kid in the present who begins exchanging letters through time with Ben Franklin. The medium of exchange is this, the kid's stepfather is a stamp collector and has all these ancient stamps, these colonial stamps, which allow the letters, I don't want to get too technical here, you know, time right. travel is a tricky thing, but the letters are able to travel through time. So Ben Franklin and this kid become correspondents. And it was great. I mean, I was writing the kid's stuff and Alan, because I'm like a 13-year-old, and Alan was writing Ben Franklin stuff because Alan is like, you know, 250. And it was great. And the funny thing is, we never met in person again until like 4 days ago. We wrote this whole book together, spoke on the phone, emails, traded chapters. We were both in New York. He took me to lunch at the Friars Club, which was incredible. Just, you know, it's the Friars Club.
Right, right.
Half the people in there looked like Robert De Niro at the end of Casino.
Once a fucking hooker, always a hooker.
Oh, fuck you. Fuck you, Sam Rothstein.
When he's got, like, glasses bigger than his face and, like, a smoking jacket and, like, a cravat, you know? Like, it's amazing. It's an amazing place.
And he told you good SNL stories, I'm hoping?
He told me SNL stories. He told me a lot of Friars Club stories, you know, Milton Berle and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, Alan's amazing. He's a really great guy and very much fun to work with.
Yeah. And screenplay-wise, is it true that, like, you offered to write the screenplay for Go the Fuck to Sleep and some other guy got the job who apparently knew the material a little better or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Fox 2000 bought the rights. They hired this one woman, Shauna Cross, initially. She wrote What to Expect When You're Expecting, which is a fucking terrible movie. And then they fired her. And it was time to hire a new writer, and I was up for the job. And I went into the Fox lot to pitch my take. It's actually a funny story. I was attempting to get there, like, I didn't want to have any extra time because I didn't want to get caught up thinking. I just wanted to walk in, pitch, you know. But I underestimated LA traffic. It was not as bad as I thought it would be, so I got there early. So I got to the Fox lot, like, 30 minutes early, parked my car, my rental. And I'm just pacing around, you know, like on the 30s street. I'm like, maybe that saloon's a real saloon. Nah, it's not. So I don't like, I have nothing to do. And I'm trying to avoid like getting caught up in nervousness. And then I realize that I don't have my wallet. And I'm like, fuck, how do I not have my wallet? Where is my wallet? I had to show ID to get on the lot. Am I such a spaz that I somehow threw my wallet out the window of my car while presenting my driver's license? I go back to the rental car. I search the rental car. I can't find it anywhere. I'm doing stupid shit that you do when you lose something, like looking in places that it couldn't possibly be. I open the trunk. I've never even opened the trunk of this rental car, but I'm sure that maybe my wallet could be in the trunk. I'm like a little bit freaking out. I'm like, I can't get on a plane without this. Like, what am I doing? And I start walking the lot, like looking at the ground for my wallet. I walk back to where I came into the lot. Nowhere to be found. But I'm also thinking, this is fucking great. Like, I'm so preoccupied with this wallet, I'm not concerned at all about this pitch. So it's time to give the pitch. I walk and I still haven't found my wallet. I give the pitch. I say everything I want to say, which is all you can do in a pitch is you don't know what they're looking for ever. All you can do is maintain fidelity to the idea you have, presented as well as it can be presented, and hope that it lines up with what they're looking for. So I was happy with how the pitch went. I went outside, searched through the car some more, found my wallet, took off. And then they called me and they were like, we're hiring this other guy. And I was like, all right, fantastic. He's also since been fired.
Amazing. Well, maybe there's another chance.
Yeah. Yeah. We just got the rights back, which is actually good. Fox put it in turnaround, which means they're done with it. So now, on the heels of publishing You Have to Fucking Eat, I have the rights to both of them back and I can go out and resell them, which I fully intended to do.
What was the movie gonna, I guess since they're not making it, it's fine to talk about, but what was their version of the movie gonna be?
I never saw either of the scripts that those people turned in, so I don't know. All I know is what I pitched, which was, in my mind, like the best version of the movie, which was kind of a four-quadrant, multi-generational family movie that had a lot of heart to it and was not just sort of crass and dumb. I think if it gets made, it'll eventually be like crass and dumb. It'll probably take place in one night and, you know, shenanigans. Mine took place over the course of a summer, you know, whatever. I may end up getting a chance to do that again, depending on what happens with the rights. So I don't know if I should talk too much about it. But, you know, it's clearly wide open for adaptation in that it's a 14-stanza book of poetry. discernible plot.
That's the weird thing. Is it like when you were selling film rights, are you like, are you sure this is film rights to this? Like,
I mean, we sold that shit so fast in the whirlwind of the initial craziness. Yeah. Like, we sold the film rights before the book was even published.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was in the zeitgeist. Whatever enters the zeitgeist, Hollywood is gonna seize on. So, I don't think they had any clear notion of how to make it a movie. They just figured, like, this is popping right now. This guy's selling a shit ton of books. We're going to buy it and figure out what to do with it later.
And you think the final movie, will it be better or worse than Adventures in Babysitting?
Meet Chris Parker. Getting ready for the greatest night of her life.
Hi.
I gotta cancel. Now she's stuck babysitting the Anderson kids. Sarah.
Mom got Chris to babysit for me.
Chris? Her brother Brad.
Oh my.
His best friend Daryl.
Who is this kid?
Stray dog.
Take good care of my baby. I'll guard her with my life.
What could possibly go wrong?
Chris, I'm in trouble.
It probably will also involve Christina Applegate. So probably about the same.
Okay. Excellent. I realize of, you know, all the zillions of things I've talked to you about at this point, the PSA with the Obama PSA is something that we've never talked about.
I hate to break it to you, sis, but all politicians are the same.
They're all the same? Big brother, please. Obama sent SEALs to bin Laden's place. Romney sent jobs overseas. And how about that student loan overhaul? It's gonna save you thousands of bucks. Mitt will cut that shit in a second. My dude, wake the fuck up.
So first off, there's a lot of slant rhymes in there. I was a little disappointed, I gotta say.
Were there? I don't even remember. I remember that I wrote it very quickly and had to satisfy a lot of people, both politically and poetically. But yeah, I'm sure it was heavy on the slant rhymes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you got a political message to get across, sometimes those rhymes have to slant.
Right. Was there, were you on set for the making of it at all?
I was, yeah. I was there the whole time.
Oh,
we shot it in one, like, 16-hour day in L.A. It was shot by a guy named Boaz Yakin, who directed Fresh, among many other movies. So he and Sam actually went back 20 years to the set of that. That was his first movie. Yeah, it was great. I mean, Sam killed it, you know. It's one of those things where Sam's call time wasn't until lunchtime. So we'd already shot a bunch of stuff with the other people. And Sam walked on, and from the first delivery of lines that he gave, the whole energy in the room just changed totally because everybody was like, oh, shit, this is going to fucking work. Like, he's killing it. Like, he's good. He's really, really good. I mean, Sam is a consummate actor. And, as soon as he stepped in the room and did his thing, everybody was just like, yo, Obama's going to win this election.
Well, I'm glad we can attribute that to Sam Jackson.
Yeah, it's nice. Absolutely.
Nice. What was something about, like, was there anything about him about, like, had you met him before he did the audiobook? Like, had you met him prior to that point?
I hadn't met him in person. We'd exchanged some emails.
Okay.
But that was the first time we got to actually kick it.
Was there anything about him in person that surprised you?
Nah, what he was exactly the cool-ass dude that you would hope he was. Super, super chill, super smart, super funny, not on any bullshit.
I want you to go in that bag and find my wallet.
Which one is it?
It's the one that says bad motherfucker.
You know, happy to be there. Everybody did this shit for free, too. You know, this was like, it was large scale. I mean, the crew was probably 60 people. So it was like Hollywood level, but a one-day shoot. And everybody was just there, you know, common cause. It was a pleasure. It was a really fun experience.
And one final thing, like at the beginning of the interview, you talked about like every morning show host in America had their idea for a sequel.
Yeah.
To you, you know, to go the fuck to sleep. What was the worst one you remember?
I mean, the ones that were really out of pocket and just seemed to be nothing but rage were the ones that I was kind of like, yo, guys, like, you know, the ones that were like, I fucking hate you and I'm going to throw you off a fucking bridge. You ruined my life, you little shit. And I'd be like, nah, yo, that's really... It's not cool, man. That's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Like, chill out with that. Maybe seek some help about that.
Nice. And what else? So what else do you have coming up? Anything we haven't touched on?
What else am I doing? I think so. I'm doing another young adult series besides the one with Alan that I'm co-writing with Craig Robinson, the actor, that my boy Keith Knight is illustrating. Keith does the K Chronicles and the Nightlife and a bunch of nationally syndicated cartoons. Very good cartoonist, funny guy. The three of us are working on a series. The first book is called Jake the Fake Keeps It Real. It's basically about a kid who gets into a performing arts school, like a magnet school for sixth grade, but kind of like bullshitted his way in there, like only actually plays one song on the piano, and that's the song he got in with. He can play song for my father, but that's about it. But his sister is a senior, and she's like the belle of the ball. She's a singer and stuff. So he's kind of like the dumbest kid in the smart school and has to kind of figure out what he's doing and how to play his position. You know, it's comedic. The ones that I'm doing with Alan are on sort of the oldest side. The we're pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable in a middle grades book content-wise. We didn't set out to write a middle grades book. We just set out to write what we wanted to write, and it got slotted in later. And we had to, like, take out a bunch of the drinking and cursing. And we were like, why don't you just make it a young adult book? And they were like, nah, because it's a male protagonist, and unless you're doing, like, fantasy wizards and warriors shit, boys that age won't buy books. So you gotta do it as a younger book because they will. So we were like, huh? What the fuck? Like, what? Okay.
Was it weird to be thrown in the middle of these, like, weirdo marketing conventions like that?
A bit, yeah. But, you know, I mean, we ultimately were okay with it. I mean, you know, it's a book we wanted to write and have be successful and commercial and meet an audience. It wasn't like some labor of love shit. I mean, it was. It was super fun. But we just figured we'll write the book that we want to write, and then we'll address what it is later. We had no idea. But by contrast, the one with Craig, that's going to sit very comfortably in the younger spectrum of, like, that genre.
Yeah.
More illustrations, you know, like a not shitty version of some wimpy kid type shit or something. Right. But I don't read these books, so I don't know anything about them. Like, I refuse to.
Yeah. And finally, so you've had time travel in a couple of books now. Rage is back, and now I guess in the new one. When you build your time machine, or maybe you already have it in a garage somewhere, where are you gonna go?
I've thought about that a lot. And you know, sadly, my answer is simply that I would probably go back to, like, 1973 and just buy up all the records and, like, maybe like, go to the Bronx and, like, become and just, like, spit Big Daddy Kane rhymes and become, you know, just, like, fuck everybody over and just be like, the greatest MC of the early days of hip-hop
right.
by stealing from people who haven't, like, gotten out of grade school yet.
Excellent. So when that happens, by the time this airs, the show will be now a tribute to Adam Mansbach,
yeah.
the great hidden lyrical genius, never recorded, sadly, never recorded, of the early days of hip-hop.
Yeah, the whole world's going to be different.
Yeah. All right, thanks a lot for coming by.
Yeah, thanks.
Adam is in some pretty rarefied company here at The Cypher Show. With this episode, he joins Faro Monch as our only three-time guest, although Bill Adler will be catching up with them next week. It's always great to talk to Adam. His children's books are hysterical, and his novels for adults are really, really wonderful. I definitely recommend you check them out. The thing he mentions in passing about Comic-Con is true. We were out having a drink last year, and he lost track of time and realized he had to go to Comic-Con to do a book signing. And so I hopped in the cab right along with him and witnessed this, you know, surreal scene he talks about of all of these people running around in superhero costumes and a bunch of thriller writers signing books for a line of fans. So thanks again to the king of cursing for kids, Adam Mansbach. As I mentioned, next week we'll be joined by former Def Jam exec and noted Christmas music nut Bill Adler for our annual holiday episode. We talk about his 30th annual Christmas mix and his featured role in the new documentary about holiday music nuts like himself, Jingle Bell Rocks. That show will be out on Christmas Eve, Tuesday the 23rd. If you enjoyed this episode of The Cypher, find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. Even more important than that, rate us and leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Feel free to reach out with any questions, comments, or ideas. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I fucking hate you, and I'm gonna throw you off a fucking bridge. You ruined my life, you little shit.
It's produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Funny guy.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
The whole energy in the room just changed totally.
We'll see you around next time on The Cypher.
Just sitting in the green room is like the worst thing in the world because you have to watch Fox News. You know what I mean? Like,
I've been there.
For me, the weird thing, like I keep expecting them to pull some like gotcha shit on me.
Yeah.
Because if they even Googled me, they would realize that I'm their enemy, you know?